Is Anthony Stevens in the room? Hello, Anthony. Sorry, I don't have a door prize for you. But I do have a nifty bio of you, Anthony Stevens. Anthony Stevens.
Yes, come forward.
Come forward, Anthony.
Tony.
Sorry. Anthony Stevens, ACB Director of Advocacy and Governmental Affairs, with over 25 years advocating on social justice issues, Anthony is an expert in Washington on advocacy in advancing the rights and causes of marginalized groups. A journalist by trade, his pursuits have taken him from the halls of ancient monasteries in Latin America to the halls of Congress, where he currently advocates on campaigns impacting Americans with disabilities. Tony sits on the board of the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities and the Aid Association for the Blind. He lives in College Park, Maryland, with his wife and two young sons. Anthony Stevens, it's a pleasure to have you here this evening.
What up, Tony?
It's
here.
So much.
Yeah, and there's a mic
somewhere.
Right here to the
there,
left.
Are there mics all around?
Yes,
yeah,
there's a mic right
we'll
here. To the
is
left
it best
here.
To sit or what's the preferred?
Sit.
Sit.
You can
protocol.
Sit.
Okay.
Be
yeah.
comfortable.
Good, I'll be comfortable. I like comfort.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah,
like
comfort
me
is good.
Too.
Man, California is so laid back. Just
dude.
Have a seat. Relax.
For sure, dude.
Good evening, everybody.
Hey.
Oh, it's 2 hours past my bedtime. Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
That's what I like to hear. That's what I like to hear.
Minutes.
You did save me 20 minutes, exactly. Thank you so much. I've been sitting in the back listening, and it's always great to hear democracy at work here in California as well, just in the sense of our own organization and for the California Council, but all of our councils. That's what's great about having the opportunity to come to state conventions like this, to get a chance to hear all the different places where people come from and knowing that we all come together towards common causes. To that end, I want to extend a huge thank you both to Judy and Jeff for the invitation, for coming here to come have a chance to give you a sense of what's going on in Washington, D.C. right now. You know, primarily because the excitement and enthusiasm of coming to the place where dreams are made as my ability to escape Washington, D.C. In current times right now. And I say this in a sense, I say this in a serious sense of, you know, I came, as was mentioned in the bio there before, I come from sort of grassroots advocacy, and being in Washington, D.C., from someone who had worked a long time in other parts around the world on other human rights causes and social justice causes, I will say in the 7 years I've lived in Washington, D.C., and been doing advocacy in our nation's capital, it is a very unique fishbowl to live in. And regardless of where you stand on the ideological spectrum, we are living in a historic time culturally in our country, as well that's being sort of magnified in Washington, D.C. So, you know, it has been an interesting past few months in Washington, D.C. I'll share a little bit about what's going on there from a larger perspective of our nation, from civil rights perspective, narrowing it down on disability rights, but primarily on the issues we with American Council of the Blind are focused on in setting a short and long-term agenda. And you know, in a sense of what I can say and what's taking place in Washington, D.C., is, you know, a lot of the lens that provides us with information from our nation's capital right now, you know, is some sense a bit askew. Hollywood, obviously, is wonderful at putting different filters on things and making things look different than sometimes they are. At the end of the day, I will say, and this is spelled out a lot in some of the advocacy that we're doing on Capitol Hill, is a large amount of the people have not changed over. Even though it seems like, and you know, when I come outside of Washington to parts of the country where a lot of people always ask me, you know, what is it like in D.C. right now? And, you know, what is the sense of such dramatic change? At the end of the day, I'm still working with the same legislative directors that were there 3 months ago. There are still day after day after day hardworking Americans throughout the federal government. And so amidst the political rhetoric that's going on, you know, I think our country is still very much in a stable situation. To that end, there has definitely been, though, some key issues regarding civil rights and protections, and regarding the budget with the president's proposed budget. But in addition to how that's going to be playing out over the next few weeks, in addition to later in the summer and probably into early fall when we get 2018 worked out, I'll talk a little bit about that in just a minute. But we are at a historical time politically and culturally, as I said. But as Americans who focus on advocacy for those who are blind or visually impaired, for the several million Americans who are legally blind, but also on the larger issues of vision loss, for the 80 million Americans who are at risk of losing their sight right now through diabetes, through heart disease, through other disabilities, we are at an interesting time historically just for our own population. When I was a kid, I've been legally blind my whole life. Went total when I was 15. They were able to restore a tiny slither in one of my eyes. It doesn't really do much, but more of an inconvenience of some might understand that. So, but in a large sense, the culture of blindness over the past generation has also changed. And I don't mean culture in a sense of socially, but in a sense of where our numbers are coming from, where they're going to be as far as the incidence for blindness in our country goes. So I'm going to be talking a little bit about that and how it frames the context, I think, in a few more minutes toward the end of my presentation here for you all today on the Washington Update. So what's going on in Washington right now? Well, it's a hooray time right now because we're about to go into a two-week recess for the Easter recess, the spring break, for when all of Congress gets on a bus and goes down to the Gulf of Mexico to Panama City Beach, Florida, and parties with MTV. No. What will be taking place the next couple weeks is Congress will be heading back to their districts. Your members of Congress will be coming back here. There will probably be some town halls. There will probably be some opportunities for local engagement. We'll talk about that at the very end, what we all can do, particularly over the next couple of weeks. I do want to share some good news with everybody. We sent out a press release this morning from ACB, and this will frame up sort of the larger context, particularly on where blindness is right now in our country and the issues that we face in the long term. But there was a bill that we had in the last Congress called the Medicare Demonstration for Low Vision Coverage of Low Vision Devices. And that bill was just reintroduced yesterday by Congresswoman Maloney of New York City. And then we had an additional co-sponsor from Tennessee, a Democrat from Tennessee, and Gus Bilirakis, a Republican from outside Tampa, who's visually impaired himself. And Congressman Bilirakis has been a strong advocate for visual impairment issues in the Congress, and we're thankful for this being a bipartisan bill that right out of the gate we're doing engagement. I sent out a letter on sort of hastily, was working today to get an email out too with some links, those on the leadership list. There will be a call to action. Hopefully you can get engaged with your members of Congress. We'll talk a little bit about that toward the end. So where are we in Washington right now though? So Congress is going on their recess, and while yes, it may seem like they're going on vacation for 2 weeks, as I said, there are still all those staffers back in Washington, D.C., and there is still a lot of work being done. At the end of the month, we have what's called a continuing resolution, or the CR, not to be confused with Creedence Clearwater Revival, CCR, one of my favorite bands growing up from California. But the CR, not CCR, is in fact going to be expiring. So they did a half-year sort of authorization for the budget. Washington works on an October 1st budget, so we are about 6 months in now, a little over 6 months. And so they got to get that amidst the backdrop, too, of what we always hear about the debt ceiling. I'm sure folks have heard that in a lot of the news over many years ago. In 2011, there was a lot of talk around the debt ceiling, and that is an issue, too, that needs to be wrestled with. These things need to get done, and then Congress will begin to start working through hearings and through other proceedings to work on the budget for 2018, which will start October 1st. Now, there was a lot of news a couple weeks ago going around about the president's budget. I will say one of the sort of inside baseball things that takes place inside the Beltway, as we call it, around Washington, D.C., is that when the president's released budget, typically those are more party line or not necessarily party line in this sense, but with President Trump working in his first budget to sort of reinforce a lot of the things that were said during the campaign. There are a lot of draconian cuts, and I don't use that word lightly, draconian, unless I'm reading, what was that book about the French painting? Never mind. What was that? The Da Vinci Code, that's what it is. So that was the first time I ever really hearing that word incessantly. But anyways, so, you know, there's a lot of posturing that goes on when the White House releases the budget. We saw the same thing with the Obama administration, where the budgets are presented. They're more of like a wish list. Paul Ryan, who's the Speaker of the House, is himself, you know, sort of a champion of the conservative side in trying to craft budgets. He's the type that will go in a room himself and write hundreds and hundreds of pages over a night or a couple of nights of what, you know, the GOP budget will look like. He did that in the past, and I assume what we will start seeing from Congress is going to be a budget more in line with his proposals. The question will be, will the president sort of work in compromising, which we've seen this with the Republicans on around health care as well, with the issues with the fact that there are multiple factions within the Republican Party, the moderates and the Freedom Caucus, that makes it very difficult in the House of Representatives to get really any full-line party effort pushed through right now. It's a very interesting political time for the Republican Party historically. We'll see how that works out. But so, you know, there's going to be a lot of continued concerns around Medicaid. In a sense, the advocates who were fighting to protect Medicaid in the American Health Care Act, which was the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, you know, there were big threats in the sense that the proposal that was presented would have essentially made Medicaid implode in on itself by 2020, when states had to really carry the major part of the bill, and that raised great concerns. You know, there was that victory of those supporting Medicaid and wanting it to not be cut when the repeal bill did not go through, when it was pulled at the last minute just before a vote a couple weeks ago. However, it is still on the table potentially for tax reform. The way the government works is for several years now, if you want to do something, you want to pay for anything, you got to take money from somewhere else. And so the concern being raised is we are about to enter into also a very large tax package. There hasn't been major tax reform since 1986 in our country. So just when we feel like after it's been 31 years, we finally figured out how to do our tax forms, they might get complex again. The EZ form is always an irony. I always thought to make it easy, whoever branded that. But we will have ourselves sort of working into that probably into the summer. And Medicaid could very well be on the chopping block for that as well. So in terms of health care reform, that's one of the main things, because there are 7 million Americans with disabilities right now that are on Medicaid. It's a major issue for those that get additional supports to assist them in being, you know, maintaining inclusion in their community. Home and community-based supports, HCBS is what they're called, the waivers that you can get through Medicaid. So that is an issue on the larger context of the larger disability community that is being fiercely fought out and trying to be protected. There are meetings by disability advocates daily in the House of Representatives, just basically reminding them that, you know, tampering with Medicaid or getting rid of services in a way is not fiscally responsible in the long run. There's a lot of talk now about the sort of the long term, focusing on the long term, in remembering that while something may make a lot of sense now, you know, we have the tendency to put human lives into numbers in Washington, D.C. That's what analysts are really good at, policy analysts. But nevertheless, there are a lot of voices out there right now, and we are gaining some traction. I think we saw that around the Affordable Health Care Act pushback that helped us sort of secure Medicaid for the temporary time right now. You know, other areas, we're continuing to watch the Department of Justice to see, you know, we think they'll probably be similar as they were during the Bush administration, where we were pleased to see that they did not get rid of the Office of Civil Rights, which holds the Disability Rights Section in Department of Justice. There's probably not going to be, you know, so much action as there was during the Obama administration. That could be a negative impact in some of the sense that we've had DOJ come to bat for us a number of times during the Obama administration around some accessibility issues, particularly around web accessibility. They're ramping up that area. I will say, though, a number of the attorneys are still on staff there at the Disability Rights Section, so we still have, you know, a sense of those advocates. The same is true. We went through a lot of work last year with the Department of Transportation and negotiated rulemaking across the disability field to make airlines more accessible for Americans who are blind, but also with other disabilities, accessible laboratories and single-aisle aircraft. I was a part of negotiations around that with other disability advocates. We made some headway on some issues. We hit a stalemate around service animals. That was an impasse. But I feel like where the Department of Transportation is right now, again, there are still a number of the attorneys who are staff, career-long, lifelong people, who I think get our position in terms of the concerns that have been risen around service animals and emotional support animals, fraudulently, people taking their pets on fraudulently, going online and getting certificates saying my Sparky here, who barks and jumps and does everything, is you know, falsely saying that they're a service animal. Our sense is that the Department of Transportation, in some sense, kind of understands our concerns and point of view, I think, in a way that while we did not reach a compromise in negotiations with the airline industry, I look forward to seeing a rule come out probably this summer. We've been told if they'll begin sort of opening the valve, if you will, the floodgate to start letting more regulations start coming through, that hopefully will be promising for that. So those are some of the cross-disability issues that have been working on. We are, you know, in a sense of also standing in solidarity with a large number of the other groups in terms of just, you know, just sort of watching the posturing and administration I'm trying to think of the best way to say this, because it's not a partisan issue. Because we found that, you know, Republicans have also been strong champions for disability rights over the years as well. But it's just in a sense of we've talked about the budget earlier, you know, there's like a significant chunk of money that would be taken out of Department of Justice. So as the budget process goes through, I think all advocates across the board on civil rights issues, on social justice issues, service issues, providing service, Department of Education with RSA, there are certain things that we're just watching because the government oftentimes when it does work, and I know there's always complaints about things not working, but when it does work, it is a strong force of monitoring and compliance and making sure that the laws like the Americans with Disability Act, the Rehabilitation Act, things like that are enforced out of the country. So that's where we are right now as far as sort of the big picture stuff goes. What does that mean as well as what's going on in Washington right now in the climate for the key issues that really matter for Americans who are blind or visually impaired, or for those that will be joining our ranks in the coming years? We know through research through the Center for Disease Control and Prevent Blindness that our numbers are going to significantly spike in the next few years. There are going to be more and more Americans come 2020. That curve is going to curve up toward 2030 as the baby boomers begin to age longer into retirement, as Americans live longer due to quality of life and health conditions and things like that. We're going to find that the incidence of blindness and visual impairment is going to increase significantly. That's going to create some supply and demand issues that we're already beginning to wrestle with right now in Washington, D.C. Primarily, I think a real good example of that is around the area of rehabilitation. As people are going to be losing their sight, we have serious concerns still with the Older Individuals with Blindness Program. We're working with a number of folks in Washington, D.C. to really try to get our heads around, an OIB program 2.0, or what can we do to increase it, where the reality that for a large number of people, they only get on average about $558 of money set aside that can help them with all their rehabilitation needs. Because as well, something called the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, which was passed a couple years ago, that bill which was passed, essentially what it did was it did excellent things for youth. It did a 15% set aside of all VR funding needs to go for youth transition, and something called supported employment services, which are services that really help people with significant disabilities. If you're blind with multiple disability, sometimes you'll need advanced service, job coaching, things like that on the job services. There's a significant chunk of money, 50% of that money has to go towards youth. What that's going to do is it's creating, and we're already hearing from some states. I was in Minnesota recently, and they had roughly $170,000 spent for youth. Now they got to spend $1.5 million on youth. That money is money that is needed at a time when our population is going to really be increasing. So it doesn't take, Princeton University or Stanford statistician to sort of see the economics and the issues that we're going to face from sort of a supply and demand issue in trying to get the services. So what do we do around older individuals with blindness program? What do we do with rehabilitation, where there was also something called the homemaker exemption, which hasn't impacted every state, but in states where you used to be able to get rehabilitation services, even if you weren't going back to get a job, you would be called a homemaker outcome. That's gone as well. So there's a lot of work. We're still waiting to find out who the new RSA commissioner is. Betsy DeVos, the Secretary of Education, was confirmed, but they're still sort of filling in those lower positions. Office of Special Education Rehabilitation Services, OSERS, and RSA. We hope those will maybe get filled by summer, but we're still waiting to find out. In fact, as we're going on, as I'm here now in Washington, the VR people from the states around the country and NCSAB, the National Council of State Agencies for the Blind, is also meeting in Washington over the next few days. So hopefully when I get back to Washington, maybe we can, hopefully maybe someone's got their ear to the ground. Because Washington loves to leak things, as you may have heard if you've watched the news at all. I wish I were that cool to know that kind of news to leak that would be of interest. But nevertheless, it's an interesting time. So what that's done for us at ACB on the national level is it's made us have to sort of think about what kind of agenda can we work on that is both focused in the short term but understanding the long-term issues that are at stake. The slow-moving train that's moving towards us, towards increased incidence, is going to impact us. It cuts into every part of our lives. Paratransit is wrestling with it, knowing that there's going to be increases in disability overall, but knowing that blindness is a much faster rate of incidence increase than the larger disability community. I looked at some data from the other year, and it was like 2% disability, while our population increased 7% a few years ago on 1 year spike. So it's creating sort of this interesting thing, from paratransit. What does it mean for housing? Any social services that are out there? How are we going to be able to wrestle with that? I mentioned the Medicare bill. That's an example of just sort of one of the short-term steps. That's when we start adding up all these steps and building them up, hopefully they can begin to help us sort of wrestle with this concern. There's a big push in Washington, not just among people who are blind and visually impaired, but the Housing and Urban Development is really looking into this as a cost, particularly Medicaid as well, for institutional care. Is how can we help Americans age in place? What are the things that we can do, as small as they can be or as large as they can be, that collectively add up to basically allow us to stay in our homes as we get older, regardless of if it's hearing or vision or, other impairments in our life that make it difficult to get out, so that we don't need to move into more costly assisted living situations, or in the worst case scenario, deplete all of our savings so that we can get onto Medicaid and then find ourselves in an institution like a nursing home. So, the Medicare is just one of those examples where what we're wanting to do is in 2008, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, called CMS, had got rid of this eyeglass through an eyeglass exclusion. Stopped paying for low vision devices that had a lens, which includes a lot of things. So that means if you're on Social Security and you have Medicare, you have a real hard time of getting these things. We're wanting Congress to do a demonstration, which is a fancy word for a research project, believing that it doesn't take rocket science to see the costs and the benefits. If we can do little things to help people stay in their home, that's going to save a lot of money down the road when you start factoring the Medicaid numbers of how much money is spent in institutional care. And as little as it may seem to say that your quality of life is, significantly improved by, let's say, being able to read your prescriptions or forms or things like that, it's these little things along the way that collectively add up. This issue is one of four or five main issues that the American Foundation for the Blind is having, this Aging and Vision Loss in the 21st Century initiative, where they're bringing together a lot of folks from AER, which is a major education rehabilitation group in D.C. that has memberships throughout the country, but also AACB is actively involved, and this is one of those four steps. They're looking at the Older Individuals with Blindness Program. They're looking at a lot of these other issues. So we're actively involved with AFB and other groups in Washington and throughout the country for folks. In fact, I'd encourage you to go to afb.org, and if you're not already, it's interesting to sign up for their list, the AVA 21 list, which is an email list, which always has interesting information from healthcare insurance to new statistics and any information that's just of interest that's going out through those lists, that really, I think, is kind of looking forward into where we're going and what can we do to ease the burden that will be placed fiscally on our communities as more and more Americans enter into vision loss and have difficulties trying to get the services they need. You know, this is a big issue to sort of talk about, and I don't want to come here and beat everybody down. Man, East Coasters are so down, and like, you know, Eeyore, like, you know, Wizard of Oz, the East Coast is so dark and glum. You know, what was it, the Witch of the East? So I don't want to come here and bring to sunny California, even though it's raining tonight, I think. I didn't bring that with me. But I don't want to come here and bring down news. But what I will say is I feel like this is an excellent opportunity for us as advocates. You know, oftentimes you get real muddy when you're in the trenches. But, you know, it also is a real sense of fertile time to really sort of take part in our democracy and really bring around transformative change that, you know, I hope I'll live long enough to be able to say I was part of that then. There, regardless of where you stand ideologically right now in Washington, D.C., one thing is clear. The American populace, we as Americans, have stood up in more times, I think, than history has noted for decades to exercise our right as citizens. We saw it the day after the election with the Women's March on Washington. You know, but it's again, it's an ideological thing that all sides of the political spectrum are engaged right now. There were a lot of pink hats that day, but there were also a lot of red hats in Washington too. So we find ourselves at a time where the American citizens are woken up. No longer do we put all of our trust just in elected officials, but we are becoming active participants in our democracy. That's where we, every one of us in this room, comes into play right now. Because we all have a sense of a duty not just to go vote, but to engage our First Amendment right to air our grievances to our government. You know, we always talk about the First Amendment being the freedom of speech and freedom of religion, but there's a third part of our First Amendment that we forget about. We have the right to go to our government and tell them what we think and how we think it needs to operate best. Regardless of where you stand politically, it's a duty that each and every one of us has. So we're entering into an interesting time over the next couple of weeks where Congress is beginning to turn its shift back to the home. What I would send an invitation or even a plea to you, everyone here in this room tonight, is a commitment. And it's a very simple commitment that you will exercise your right as a citizen to engage in your democracy in whatever little way you can. Tell your story to somebody. It could be someone on the bus, or it could be someone in a congressional office here at the district office. But the more that we talk about the issues that are important to us, the more that we create an echo chamber. And I will tell you this, there is a lot, and I mean a lot, of noise right now in Washington, D.C. It is very difficult to go to the Hill now. When we had our Hill Day on February 28th, it was the busiest day I've ever had on the Capitol. It was everybody from every side of the aisle there. The president was giving his speech to the joint session of Congress that night. And it is an exciting time to be in Washington, as crazy as it may seem. And you know, me being sort of the person that's not a Washingtonian by culture at all, I hate ties and suits, which is another reason I'm thankful to come out to California. Thank you. But in that sense, you know, I think that every one of us has an opportunity. And that opportunity is very simple. Find a way to get your story out there on the issues that matter to you. And the issues that don't, just remember, advocate means to speak on behalf of someone. You know, we're all self-advocates from the moment we're born. When the first thing we do when we come out into this world is we scream and cry, right? We speak up. But as an advocate, everyone here in this room is an advocate too, because we just don't talk about ourselves, we talk about others. We talk about our loved ones, our grandparents, our parents, or ourselves, or our children, or whoever, or aunts and uncles. Somebody that means something to us, even if it's ourselves. And we find a way to get engaged. So I encourage you all to find ways in your local chapters, invite a member of Congress or a congressional staffer out to. Has anybody ever invited a congressional person or a staffer to your district meetings? Has anybody done that? Think of that. Think of it. These are simple things. So, you know, I'm in Washington, D.C., happy to whatever we can do to try to put you in touch with people. You know, it's busy times. I'm an email guy. That's me personally. Leave voicemails. I'll try to get back to you as soon as I can. If you ping me on email, you'll hear back from me at 3 a.m., but I'm not going to call you at 3 a.m., I promise. But to that end, you know, I think on a positive issue, too, just to leave, we are making ground on Marrakesh. We reached a compromise between the publishers and the authors. So that's some good news. I leave you with good news there. So we had a meeting with, you know, with the Senate, and they're looking at the right now the Judiciary Committee, last I heard, and the head of the Foreign Relations Committee is willing to push that through. We don't have any dates or anything right now. Congress has a very short attention span, so we're trying to keep that on their focus. But we were glad that we almost had it last year, and the publishers and the libraries hit sort of a stalemate, but we overcame that. So we're fortunate about Marrakesh. You know, there are some things that are going to be happening that are positive in Washington, D.C. So I'm happy to take any questions now or afterwards. I don't know if we have time for Q&A. But, you know, in a sense of, you know, accessibility, too, I'm here tomorrow as well. If folks have any questions or concerns, you're welcome to try to find me. I think someone has a question in the back. Gentleman in the back. Mr. Augusto, I'm fabulous, sir. It's hard to hear you up here. Sorry.
Do we have just a couple of
hold on,
things
hold on one second, Carl. We have a roaming mic.
Hi. First of all, I just want everyone here to know that if you haven't seen Tony in action, you've seen him tonight. He is an incredible advocate, and ACB is so lucky to have him leading our governmental relations office in D.C. Wow.
You're very kind, Carl.
Secondly, it was very nice to hear you talk about the partnership with that other organization that I'm very fond of called the American Foundation for the Blind. And I'm glad that that partnership continues to thrive. We've enjoyed a very rich tradition between AFB and ACB, and Tony, I know, is an advocate for continuing it. And the third thing is just, I didn't hear you talk about the Cogswell-Macy Act, and I know it's a long-term thing. It might not happen until the education reauthorization, but can you give us a...
You know, I'll say something real quick on education, though, which has been promising. And yes, the Cogswell-Macy Act was reintroduced thanks to Barbara, is her name, that's an advocate for the deaf that has been very, very solid in getting that help to get that reintroduced. It was something we had some flyers that we, or not flyers, I should say, backgrounders that we all had our members pass out when they came up to Washington, because it was introduced just a couple of days, I think, before we had our Washington conference. As far as climate goes, Van Jones said to Dr. King, he never said, I have a complaint, I have a dream. So I will try to be optimistic in the sense of IDEA coming up in this Congress. I don't think realistically it will. At least we've heard that from the Senate side. I haven't had a chance to... I met with a staffer on another issue for Congresswoman Fox, who's the chairwoman of that committee in the House. But, you know, it's not so much on the radar now. But one thing that was promising... There was a lot of fear of how IDEA in general, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which Cogswell-Macy sort of would help sort of fix. For those that don't know Cogswell-Macy, it kind of builds on the fundamental principle that, you know, on education, not everybody's equal. We all come from different places and have different needs in our education, and works to try to remedy the uniqueness that people with sensory disabilities have. You know, it was promising in the Supreme Court decision recently, Andrew F. versus, I'm horrible at remembering this when I should be sleeping right now, who that was for. But it was a unanimous, the courts have ruled twice unanimous decisions for kids with disabilities in schools, the Supreme Court recently. And it was unanimous. I think it's one of those mom and apple pie things where the messaging is strong, where we say, look, you know, there's $18 million or whatever, not $18 million, but whatever it is being spent on special education. You know, it makes a lot of sense in Cogswell-Macy the way it's set up,
to spend our money wisely, to say we're not throwing the money away in trying to serve students who are blind or deaf or deaf-blind. And it's a message, I think, that's a positive message, that's a bipartisan message. It is not right now on the plate of everything, and I'm an office of one, a department of one. Forgive me for that, Carl, for not wearing the flag tonight for Cogswell Macy. We have a lot going on, but we're definitely not ignoring it. It's kind of the time and place kind of issue. And I think when the time is right, I think the messaging is continuing to be pushed, and Mark Reichert with AFB is doing an excellent job of really championing education causes, as well as Luta with AER and others that are working in that sphere. And so we're working tangentially on it. It's just not a key imperative right now with the political capital that we have in trying to wrestle with some of the other issues that are priorities right now for us.
One more question,
anybody?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Oh, I think we got a mic coming.
Thank you. Tony, thank you very much for being here. I think we all know that in relative or absolute terms, whether through the budget process, tax law changes, healthcare changes, we all know that to some degree what we broadly call social programs are going to be cut. That creates a dilemma, and what I perceived when we were back in Washington in February was almost a great moral issue facing ACB and organizations like ACB, and that is, are we going to fight along a broad front for preservation of all or as many programs and benefits and services and human needs as we can, or are different constituencies with different interests and different followings going to try to make their own separate pieces, as it were, and pull out the pieces that they can? And that is the great moral struggle that I see going on throughout the human services and nonprofit sector now.
You know, and I'm glad you raised that up, and if folks go to our website, acb.org, and you can search for the 2017 legislative imperatives, one of those was to focus on six issues that I think don't get a lot of talk. When we look at a lot of the talking, book services would get cut in the president's budget through the Institute for Museum and Library Services, or Science, or whatever, IMS, I always get that acronym, IMLS. There are a lot of things that we rely on as people who are blind that are on the chopping block. And it's almost like whack-a-mole. You get one, and then one pops right back up that you're like, I never knew about that. I didn't even know that agency existed. And it's difficult, and it does raise, that moral question, because there were a lot of issues that we, focused on right out of the gate with the administration and the transition. But then you get things that come up that are significant for millions of people. So you have to try to weigh your political capital in Washington. Do we go out and sort of be rogue and focus on these smaller issues that I know the larger disability community doesn't get behind us? Of course we do, because sometimes you got to speak out on those issues. I feel like we were able to do that in looking through some of the feedback. There's key feedback that we get back from people. That sounds like some of those messages resonating. And in a sense, though, too, we have to focus on the larger issue, and it's finding that balance right now in Washington. And it's a challenge. It is a real challenge for everybody because, there's also, I didn't even mention the ADA notifications, education notifications bill, which we've gone on working with other disability groups, which could very much curtail after some people might have checked out that 60 Minutes piece on ADA drive-by lawyers that came out back in November, December, whenever it was. That's resonated a lot across both sides of Congress, and there's a bill now that we're very much fighting to try to stop. Basically, it's the small shopping centers lobby group, like strip malls, shopping centers are really pushing hard against for this bill. And it's like things like that pop up right when you're feeling like you're making ground in another area. So it's a constant juggling act in Washington, and it is measuring that. So, we try to focus on the short term, but you have to focus on the long term, and it's the best steps toward moving forward are, yes, we're going to get some punches, yes, we're going to get hurt, yes, we're going to get knocked down, and there could be some hard times ahead. Which is more important as to why we need to align short-term with long-term and make sure that everything we do in the short term is sustaining the long term to carry us over that wave. I remember I tried surfing once on teeny tiny East Coast waves when I could still see nothing compared to like out here. But, you know, you got to really, really work, just to get, you know, a few seconds of opportunity in the long term. So a lot of short-term paddling. So, you know, our hope is that we can try to set forward a legislative agenda that tries to wrestle with that moral issue you're talking about. Because otherwise you can't sleep at night. If you sit there and think of everything that's at risk, it can be overwhelming, to be just honest, you know. Did that answer your question? That was a long soliloquy, I apologize. You know, I want to thank you all so much. I have, my mother and father were married in Monterey, so in some sense I'd like to think I sort of came out of California. And so I will say that it's nice to get out here whenever I do get out here, even though I brought rain. But thank you. This is a wonderful opportunity to get to meet some of you, and I hope to meet more of you over the next 24, 48 hours whenever I'll be flying back. But again, thanks to Judy and Jeff and everyone else. And let us know what we can do in the national office. We're there to help you. But I give you a plea, too, to help us by going out and telling your story. Thank you.
Tony, thank you very much.